This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Green Lights, and I am the author, Matthew McConaughey. To the only thing I ever knew I wanted to be, and family. Green Lights, January 22nd, 1989, titled I've Found Myself, Question, the most difficult word in the universe, who, what, where, when, how. And that's the truth. Why is even bigger, I ask. I think I'll write a book, a word about my life. I wonder who would give a damn about the pleasure and the strife. I think I'll write a book, help the generations with the truth about the past. Who's to say one would agree? Shit, I'm tired. Hope that these thoughts last. I shall think I will write a book. Mood for the sayings, favorite one, psychological, let life be, no. Then we are cowards if we let it be. Just write a book. It's from one of my journals, January 22nd, 1989. On with this book I titled Green Lights. Here we go. This is not a traditional memoir. Yes, I tell stories from the past, but I have no interest in nostalgia, sentimentality, or the retirement that most memoirs require. This is not an advice book either. Although I like preachers, I'm not here to preach and tell you what to do. This is an approach book. I am here to share stories, insights, and philosophies that can be objectively understood and, if you choose, subjectively adopted by either changing your reality or changing how you see it. This is a playbook based on adventures in my life. Adventures that have been significant, enlightening, and funny, sometimes because they were meant to be, but mostly because they did not try to be. Look, I'm an optimist by nature, and humor has been one of my great teachers. It has helped me deal with pain, loss, and lack of trust. I am not perfect. No, I step in shit all the time and recognize it when I do. I've just learned how to scrape it off my boots and carry on. Because we all step in shit from time to time. We hit roadblocks. We fuck up. We get fucked. We get sick. We don't get what we want. We cross thousands of could-have-done-betters and wish that wouldn't have happened in life. Stepping in shit is inevitable. So let's either see it as good luck or figure out how to do it less often. To life. I've been in this life for 50 years, trying to work out its riddle for 42 and keeping diaries of clues to that riddle for the last 35. Notes about successes and failures, joys and sorrows, things that made me marvel and things that made me laugh out loud. 35 years of realizing, remembering, recognizing, gathering, and jotting down what has moved me or turned me on along the way. How to be fair, how to have less stress, how to have fun, how to hurt people less, how to get hurt less, how to be a good man, how to get what I want, how to have meaning in life, how to be more me. Now, I never wrote these things down to remember. I always wrote things down so I could forget. The idea of revisiting my life and musings was a daunting one. I wasn't sure if I'd enjoy the company. Recently, I worked up the courage to sit down with those diaries and have a look at the 35 years of writing about who I've been over the last 50. And you know what? I enjoyed myself more than I thought I would. I laughed, I cried, I realized I had remembered more than I expected and forgot less. What did I find? I found stories I witnessed and experienced, lessons I learned and forgot, poems, prayers, prescriptions, answers to questions I had, reminders of questions I still have, affirmations for certain doubts, beliefs about what matters, theories on relativity, and a whole bunch of bumper stickers. I found consistent ways that I approached life that gave me more satisfaction at the time and still. I found a reliable theme. So I packed up those journals and took a one-way ticket to solitary confinement in the desert, where I began writing what you hear now. An album, a record, a story of my life so far. Things I witnessed, dreamed, chased, gave, and received. Truth bombs that interrupted my space and time in ways I could not ignore. Contracts I have made with myself, many of which I live up to, most of which I still pursue. These are my sights and scenes, felt and figured out, cools and shamefuls, graces, truths, and beauties of brutality, initiations, invitations, calibrations, and graduations, getting away with, getting caught, and getting wet, trying to dance between the raindrops. Rites of passage. All between are on the other side of persistence and letting go, on the way to the science of satisfaction in this great experiment called life. Hopefully, it's medicine that tastes good. A couple of aspirin instead of the infirmary. A spaceship to Mars without needing your pilot's license. Going to church without having to be born again and laughing through the tears. It's a love letter to life. Now, speaking of bumper stickers, I have always loved bumper stickers. So much so that I've stuck bumper to sticker and made them one word, bumper sticker. They're lyrics, one-liners, quick hitters, unobtrusive personal preferences that people publicly express. They're cheap and they're fun. They don't have to be politically correct because, well, they're just bumper stickers. From the font they're in, to the color scheme, to the word or words they say, a bumper sticker tells you a lot about the person behind the wheel in front of you. Their political views, if they've got a family or not, if they're free spirits or conformist, funny or serious, what kind of pets they have, what kind of music they like, even what their religious beliefs might be. Over the last 50 years, I've been collecting my bumper stickers. Some I've seen, some I've heard, some I stole, some I dreamed, some I said. Some are funny, some are serious, but they all stuck with me. Because that's what bumper stickers do. I've included quite a few of my favorites in this book. The sole objective is the pursuit of the singular finish with only the arrival in sight. This is what brings us together. Sometimes you got to go back to go forward. And I don't mean going back to reminisce or chase ghosts. I mean go back to see where you came from, where you've been, how you got here. That's me from a Lincoln ad in 2014. You might remember that one. It got parodied quite a bit. Sold a lot of cars, too. So, how did I get here? Well, I've earned a few scars getting through this rodeo of humanity. I've been good at it. I've been not so good at it. And ultimately, I've found some pleasure in all of it, either way. Here are some facts about me to help set the table. I am the youngest brother of three and the son of parents who were twice divorced and thrice married to each other. We grew up saying, I love you to each other. We meant it. I got whipped until my butt bled for putting on a Cracker Jack tattoo when I was 10 years old. When I first threatened to run away from home, my parents packed my bags for me. My dad wasn't there the day I was born. He called my mom and said, only thing I have to say is if it's a boy, don't name him Kelly. The only thing I ever knew I wanted to be in life was a father. I learned to swim when my mom threw me in the Llano River and I was either going to float off the rocky waterfall 30 yards downstream or make it back to the bank. I made it to the bank. I was always the first one to wear out the knees in my tough skin jeans. For 2 years, I led the under-12 soccer league in red cards as a goalie. When I kept whining about my lone pair of tennis shoes being old and out of fashion, my mom told me, keep griping, and I'll take you to meet the boy with no feet. I was blackmailed into having sex for the first time when I was 15. I was certain I was going to hell for the premarital sex. Today, I am merely certain that I hope that's not the case. I was molested by a man when I was 18 while knocked unconscious in the back of a van. I've done peyote in Real de Catorce, Mexico, in a cage with a mountain lion. I've had 78 stitches sewn into my forehead by a veterinarian. I've had 4 concussions from falling out of 4 trees, 3 of them on a full moon. I have bongoed naked until the cops arrested me. I have resisted arrest. I applied to Duke, University of Texas at Austin, Southern Methodist, and Grambling for my college education. I got accepted to 3 out of 4. I've never felt like a victim. I have a lot of proof that the world is conspiring to make me happy. I've always gotten away with more in my life than in my dreams. I've had many people give me poems that I did not know I wrote. I've been naive, evil, and a cynic, but I am most fearless in my belief of my and mankind's benevolence and the common denominator of the values among us. I believe the truth is only offensive when we're lying. I was raised on existential outlaw logic, a carnation of malaprops, full of fictitious physics. Because if it wasn't true, it ought to be. There was nothing fictitious about the love, though. The love was real. Bloody sometimes, but never in question. I learned early on how to get relative, how to deal. I learned resilience, consequences, responsibility, and how to work hard. I learned how to love, laugh, forgive, forget, play, and pray. I learned how to hustle, sell, charm, turn a tide, make a downfall my upfall and spin a yarn. I learned how to navigate highs and lows, hugs and blows, assets and deficits, love songs and epithets, especially when faced with the inevitable. This is a story about getting relative with the inevitable. This is a story about green lights. The arrival is inevitable. Death. A unanimous end, a unified destination, a noun without regard, our eulogy written and lived. The approach is relative. Life, a singular procession, our personal journey, a verb with regard, our resume, write it, live it. This is the first 50 years of my life, of my resume so far, on the way to my eulogy. All right, so first question that you probably have is, what's a green light? Well, green lights mean go, advance, carry on, continue. On the road, they're set up to give the flow of traffic the right of way, and when scheduled properly, more vehicles catch more green lights in succession. They say proceed. In our lives, they are an affirmation of our way. Their approvals, support, praise, gifts, gas on our fire, attaboys, and appetites. Their cash, money, birth, springtime, health, success, joy, sustainability, innocence, and fresh starts. You see, we love green lights. They don't interfere with our direction. They're easy. They're like a shoeless summer. They say yes and give us what we want. Green lights can also be disguised as yellow and red lights. A caution, a detour, a thoughtful pause, an interruption, a disagreement, indigestion, sickness, and pain. A full stop, a jackknife, an intervention, failure, suffering, a slap in the face, death. We don't like yellow and red lights. No, they slow us down or stop our flow. They're hard. They're a shoeless winter. They say no, but sometimes give us what we need. Catching green lights is about skill. Intent, context, consideration, endurance, anticipation, resilience, speed, and discipline. We can catch more green lights by simply identifying where the red lights are in our life and then change course to hit fewer of them. We can also earn green lights, engineer and design for them. We can create more and schedule them in our future, a path of least resistance. Through force of will, hard work, and the choices we make, we can be responsible for green lights. Catching green lights is also about timing, the world's timing and ours. When we are in the zone, on the frequency, and with the flow, we can catch green lights by sheer luck because we are in the right place at the right time. Catching more green lights in our future can be about intuition, karma, and fortune. Sometimes catching green lights is about fate. Navigating the Autobahn of life in the best way possible is about getting relative with the inevitable at the right time. The inevitability of a situation is not relative. When we accept the outcome of a given situation as inevitable, then how we choose to deal with it is relative. We either persist and continue in our present pursuit of our desired result, pivot and take a new tack to get it, or concede altogether and tally one up for fate. We push on, call an audible, or wave the white flag and live to fight another day. The secret to our satisfaction lies in which one of these we choose to do when. This is the art of living. I believe everything we do in life is part of a plan. Sometimes the plan goes as intended, and sometimes it doesn't. That's part of the plan. Realizing this is a green light in itself. The problems we face today eventually turn into blessings in the rearview mirror of life. In time, yesterday's red light leads us to a green light. All destruction eventually leads to construction. All death eventually leads to birth. All pain eventually leads to pleasure. In this life or the next, what goes down will come up. It's a matter of how we see the challenge in front of us and how we engage with it. Persist, pivot, or concede. It's up to us, our choice, every time. This is a book about how to catch more yeses in a world of no's and how to recognize when a no might actually be a yes. This is a book about catching green lights and realizing that the yellows and the reds eventually turn green. Green lights. by design and on purpose. Good luck. Now for a poem. If all that I would want to do would be to sit and talk to you, would you listen? Matthew McConaughey, age 12. Wink, wink. Part 1. Outlaw Logic. It was a Wednesday night, 1974. Dad had just gotten home from work, creasy blue button-down with Jim on the left chest patch already thrown in the washer. He sat at the head of the table in his sleeveless undershirt. He was hungry. My brothers and I had eaten already, and Mom pulled his reheated plate from the oven and shoved it in front of him. "More potatoes, honey," he said as he dug in. My dad was a big man. 6'4", 265 pounds, his fighting weight, he'd say. Any lighter, I'd catch a cold. At 44 years old, those 265 pounds were hanging in places that, at this Wednesday evening dinner, my mom didn't fancy. "Sure you want more potatoes, fat man," she barked. I was crouching behind the couch in the living room, starting to get nervous. But Dad, head down, quietly continued to eat. "Look at you, that fat belly of yours. Sure, eat up, fat man," she yapped as she scraped overwhelming amounts of mashed potatoes onto his plate. And that was it. Boom! Dad flipped the dining room table into the ceiling, got up and began to stalk Mom. "God damn it, Katie, I work my ass off all day. I come home, I just want to eat a hot meal in peace." It was on. My brothers knew the deal. I knew the deal. Mom knew the deal as she ran to the wall-mounted telephone on the other side of the kitchen to call 911. "You can't leave well enough alone, can you, Katie?" my dad grumbled through gritted teeth, his forefinger raised at her as he closed in across the kitchen floor. As he closed in, Mom grabbed the handheld end of the phone off the wall mount and raked it across his brow. Dad's nose was broken. Blood was everywhere. Mom then ran to the cabinet and pulled out a 12-inch chef's knife, then squared off at him. "Come on, fat man. I'll cut you from your nuts to your Gulliver." They circled each other in the middle of the kitchen, Mom waving the 12-inch blade, Dad with his bloody broken nose and snarling teeth. He grabbed a half-full 14-ounce bottle of Heinz ketchup off the counter, unscrewed the cap, and brandished it like a blade. "Come on, fat man," Mom dared him again. "I'll cut you wide open." Assuming the stance of a mocking matador, Dad began to fling ketchup from the open bottle across Mom's face and body. "Touché," he said as he pranced right to left. The more he flipped ketchup on her and dodged her slashing chef's knife, the more frustrated Mom got. "Touché again," Dad teased as he splattered a new red stripe across her while eluding another attack. Around and around they went until finally Mom's frustration turned to fatigue. Now covered in ketchup, she dropped the knife on the floor, stood straight, and began to wipe her tears and catch her breath. Dad dropped the bottle of Heinz, relaxed out of his matador pose, and wiped the blood dripping from his nose with his forearm. Still facing off, weapons down, they stared at each other for a moment. Mom thumbing the ketchup from her wet eyes, Dad just standing there, letting the blood drip from his nose down his chest. Seconds later, they moved toward each other and met in an animal embrace. They dropped to their knees, then to the bloody, ketchup-covered linoleum kitchen floor and made love. A red light turned green. This is how my parents communicated. This is why Mom handed Dad an invite to their own wedding and said, "You got 24 hours to decide. Let me know." This is why my mom and dad were married 3 times and divorced 2x to each other. This is why my dad broke Mom's middle finger to get it out of his face 4 separate times. This is how my mom and dad loved each other. The golden rule and everything in moderation. 2 adages, often solicited as general rules for life. There's a loophole in each. Sometimes people don't want to do what you want to do. And one man's appetite is another's indigestion. The McConaughey clan migrated from Ireland to Liverpool, England, to Little Rock, West Virginia, and New Orleans. There is no royalty in our past. There is, however, a lot of cattle thieving, riverboat gambling, and an Al Capone bodyguard. Dad is from Paterson, Mississippi, but grew up and felt most at home in Morgan City, Louisiana. Mom's from Altoona, Pennsylvania, but always said she was from Trenton, New Jersey, because who'd want to be from a place called Altoona? I have 2 brothers, The oldest, Michael, has been going by Rooster for 40 years now because even if he goes to sleep at 4 a.m., he always awakes at sunrise. When he turned 10, he wanted a little brother for his birthday present, so Mom and Dad adopted my brother Pat from the Methodist home in Dallas in 1963. Every year, Mom and Dad offered to take Pat to meet his birth parents. He declined until he turned 19 and finally took them up on their offer. Mom and Dad arranged the meeting, and the three of them drove to the home of Pat's birth parents in Dallas. Parked curbside, Mom and Dad waited in the car while Pat rang the doorbell and went inside. 2 minutes later, Pat walked out of the house and jumped in the back seat. Well, what happened? They asked him. I just wanted to see if my dad was bald because my hair's thinning. Mm-hmm. Pictures. Mom and Dad were first married December 22nd, 1954, and then they got divorced, then they got married again December the 18th, 1959. Almost made it 5 years. Well, they ended up married until Pop moved on, but that story will come later. Me, I was an accident. Mom and Dad had been trying to make a baby for years to no avail, so Mom thought I was a tumor until the 5th month of pregnancy. Dad went to the bar instead of the hospital the day I was born because he suspected I wasn't his anyway. But I was. I got my first ass whooping for answering to Matt on the kindergarten playground. You weren't named after a doormat, Mom screamed. My second for saying I hate you to my brother. My third for saying I can't. And my fourth for telling a lie about a stolen pizza. I got my mouth washed out with soap for saying shit, damn, or fuck. But I only ever got in real trouble for using or doing of the words that could harm me. Words that hurt. The words that helped engineer who I am because they were more than just words. They were expectations and consequences. They were values. My parents taught me that I was named my name for a reason. They taught me not to hate, to never say I can't, to never lie. Green light. Words are momentary. Intent is momentous. My parents didn't hope we would follow their rules. They expected us to. A denied expectation hurts more than a denied hope, while a fulfilled hope makes us happier than a fulfilled expectation. Hope's got a higher return on happiness and less debit on denial. It's just not as measurable. My parents measured. And while I'm not advocating for physical punishment as a consequence, I do know that there are a lot of things I didn't do as a kid that I shouldn't have done because I didn't want to get my ass whooped. I also know that I did a lot of things as a kid that I should have done because I wanted my parents' praise and adulation. Consequences. They work both ways. I come from a loving family. We may not have always liked each other, but we always loved each other. We hug and kiss and wrestle and fight. We don't hold a grudge. I come from a long line of rule breakers, outlaw libertarians who vote red down the line because they believe it'll keep fewer outlaws from trespassing on their territory. I come from a family of disciplinarians where you better follow the rules until you're man enough to break them. Where you did what Mom and Dad said because I said so, and if you didn't, you didn't get grounded. You got the belt or a backhand because it gets your attention quicker and doesn't take away your most precious resource, time. I come from a family who took you across town to your favorite cheeseburger and milkshake joint to celebrate your lesson learned immediately following your corporal correction. I come from a family that might penalize you for breaking the rules, but definitely punished you for getting caught. Slightly calloused on the surface, we know that what tickles us often bruises others. Because we deal or deny it, we're the last to cry uncle to bad luck. It's a philosophy that has made me a hustler in both senses of the word. I work hard and I like to grift. It's a philosophy that's also led to some great stories. Like a good Southern boy should, I'll start with my mom. She's a true baller, living proof that the value of denial depends on one's level of commitment to it. She's beat two types of cancer on nothing more than aspirin and denial. She's a woman that says, I'm gonna before she can, I would before she could, and I'll be there before she's invited. Fiercely loyal to convenience and controversy, she's always had an adversarial relationship with context and consideration because they ask permission. She might not be the smartest person in the room, but she ain't crying. She's 88 now, and seldom do I go to bed after her or wake up before her. Her curfew when she was growing up was when she danced holes big enough in the feet of her pantyhose that they came up around her ankles. Nobody forgives themselves quicker than she does, and therefore she carries zero stress. I once asked her if she ever went to bed with any regrets. She quickly told me, "Oh, every night, son. I just forget them by the time I wake up." She always told us, "Don't you walk into a place like you want to buy it. Walk in like you own it." Obviously, her favorite word in the English language is yes. In 1977, Mom entered me into the Little Mr. Texas contest in Bandera, Texas. I won a big trophy. My mom framed this picture and put it on the kitchen wall. There I am, cowboy hat, trophy in hand. Every morning when I came to breakfast, she gestured to it and said, "Look at you, winner, Little Mr. Texas 1977. Well, last year, 2019, I came across the picture in her scrapbook when something caught my eye. Curious, I zoomed in on the nameplate on the trophy. It said, runner-up. I called the queen of relativity, my mom, and said, "Mom, all my life you told me that I was Little Mr. Texas, but I was really runner-up." And she said, no, the kid who won it, his family had a lot more money than us, and they bought him that fancy three-piece suit for the contest. No, we call that cheating. No, you're Little Mr. Texas. Yep, that's Mom. Then in 1982, I entered the 7th grade poetry contest. The night before the deadline, I showed my poem to Mom. Not bad. Keep working, she said. I headed back to my room to work on the next draft. A couple hours later, happy with my progress, I took my poem to Mom again. She read it, said nothing. "Well, what do you think?" I asked. She didn't answer. Instead, she opened up a hardcover book to a pre-marked page, put it in front of me, pointed, and said, "What do you think of that?" I read it. "If all that I would want to do would be to sit and talk to you, would you listen?" It was a poem by Anne Ashford. "I like it," I said. "Why?" "Then write that," Mom said. "Write this? What do you mean?" "Do you understand it?" "Yeah, but if you like it and you understand it, then it's yours." "But it's not really mine, Mom. It's Anne Ashford's. Does it mean anything to you?" "Well, yeah, it's like when someone you love just wants to sit and talk with you." "Exactly. So if you like it and you understand it and it means something to you, it's yours. Write that." "And sign my name to it?" "Yes, I did. And I won the 7th grade poetry contest." My mom had no upbringing, and since she didn't like her life growing up, to survive, she denied it and constructed her own. She's always believed that if you understand something, then you own it. You can sign your name to it, take credit for it, live by it, sell it, and win medals for it. Plagiarism? Shit. They'll probably never find out, and if they do, all they can do is blame you and take your medal back, so fuck them, she says. Obviously, my mom is prepping me to be an actor long before it became my vocation. Green light. Knowing the truth, seeing the truth, and telling the truth are all different experiences. While Mom taught us audacious existentialism, Dad taught us common sense. He was a man who valued sirs and ma'ams, discipline, loyalty, persistence, work ethic, humility, rites of passage, respect of women, and making enough money to secure your family. He also painted, took ballet, played for the Green Bay Packers, loved to roll the dice, chase Ponzi schemes, win something instead of buying it, and dreamed of owning a gumbo shack on the beach in Florida if he could ever hit a lick big enough to retire. Deconstructing to construct his three sons, Dad respected yellow lights, and he made sure we learned the fundamentals before we expressed our individualism. To use a football term, he taught us to block and tackle before we could play wideout. It was clear who the man of the house was, and if any of his three boys wanted to challenge that notion, "You know where to find me," he'd say. We feared him, not because he ever hurt or abused us, but because he was our father. We looked up to him. He was above the law and government, and he didn't suffer fools, unless you admitted to being one. A bear of a man with a soft spot for the underdog and the helpless, he had a rowdy wit about the world and himself. "Oh, I'd rather lose money having fun than make money being bored," he'd say. He was also a proud man, and if you gave him a second chance, he'd never forget it. One time in the late 80s, after a banker declined a loan to bail him out of debt, he said, "Now look, you can shut that door on me, or we can walk through it together." He got the loan, and they walked through it. He loved to host a party, drink beer, and tell stories, and he was a hand at all three. His eldest son was Mike. He had more to do with raising Mike than Pat or me because, one, Mike was his first, and two, Dad had to work from the road more often later in life. Mike was a confident, scrappy, hard-working, savvy guy with a hippie heart full of compassion for the runts of the world. Cool under pressure with the pain threshold of a badger, he's the first person you'd want with you when the going got tough. He survived so many near deaths, Mom always said about him. You and Pat need praying for. With Mike, it don't matter. Raised on a reverence for the Old Testament, we were a religious family. But it wasn't all fire and brimstone. No, the more merciful teachings of Jesus also had their place in our parents' principles. When Mike was in high school, he started to grow long hair. It grew long enough that the coach of his football team, Jim Caldwell, asked him to get it cut. My dad agreed, but Mike refused. Driving Mike to school the next day, my dad said, "You look like a hippie, son, and if you don't cut your hair, coach is going to cut you from the team." "I don't care, Pop. It's my hair. And if he wants to cut me from the team, then he can cut me. I'm not cutting my hair." "Now, son, listen to me, all right? Quit being stubborn and just cut your damn hair." Indignant, Mike said, "No, sir, Dad. I'm not doing it. Son, I'm telling you." "Well, Jesus had long hair, too," Mike blurted. Quiet. Playing the religious card was a crafty move, and Mike knew it might have sealed the deal in his favor. Dad, in silence, just continued to drive. Just as they were about to arrive at the school entrance, Mike, believing his Jesus tactic had worked, Dad hit the gas and sped by. "What the hell, Dad? What are you doing?" Mike asked. Dad proceeded to drive 8 miles past Mike's school, not saying a word. Suddenly, he pulled off to the side of the road, leaned over and opened the passenger door, pushed my brother out the door and said, "Yeah? Well, Jesus walked everywhere too, boy." My brother was late for school that day, not only because my dad dropped him off 8 miles from it, but because he stopped by the barber shop on his way there. Dad had worked his way up from a Texaco gas station manager to pipe hauler to pipe salesman in a local company called Jensco. He was a damn good pipe salesman. He got Mike a job selling pipe at Jensco as well. My brother became a great pipe salesman, and quickly. In less than a year, at 22 years of age, Mike was the top salesman in the company. The boss put him on their biggest account, a buyer named Don Knowles. Dad was truly proud of Mike, but Mike was still his son. We had an old wooden barn in the back of our house by the dirt alleyway where Dad kept an unloaded 18-wheeler from his pipe hauling days. It was a Saturday night. "Let's drink some beer and throw knives in the barn tonight, son," Dad told Mike. "Sure, Pop. I'll see you around sundown." Around 10 o'clock, after quite a few beers, Dad finally bellied up. "Let's go roll some pipe like we used to, son. It's been a while." A rolling pipe is when you take an unloaded 18-wheeler to someone else's pipe yard, load their pipe on it, drive away, and steal it. Dad and Mike used to do it on certain Saturday nights back when Dad was hauling. "Well, whose pipe you want to roll, Pop?" Dad squared off at Mike and said, "Don Knowles." "Oh, shit." "Nah, Dad, I'm not doing that. I just got Don Knowles' account. You know that." "I do know that. I got you the job at Jensco, boy. You wouldn't have that account if it wasn't for me. Where's your loyalty lie, son? With your old man or Don fucking Knowles?" "Now, Dad, you know that ain't fair." "What ain't fair, boy? You too good now to roll pipe with your old man like we used to, huh? You too big time now, boy?" "Oh, shit." "Now, Dad, easy." Dad took off his shirt. "No, let's see how big time you are now, boy. You think you're man enough to not listen to your old man? You're going to have to whoop him to prove it." "Now, Dad, I don't want to." Whop! Dad walloped an open-palmed right hand across Mike's face. Mike stumbled a step back, then straightened up and started rolling up his sleeves. "So this is how it's going to be," Mike said. "Yep, this is how it's going to be. Come on, boy." Now, Dad was 6'4", 265 pounds. Mike was 5'10", 180. Oh, shit. Dad, now crouched, stepped in with a right hook across Mike's jaw. Mike went down. Dad stalked toward him. On the ground, gathering himself, Mike saw a 5-foot 2x4 laying on the ground next to him. And just as Dad came in for another blow, Mike grabbed that 2x4 and baseball bat swung it across the right side of Dad's head. Whop! Dad stumbled back, sincerely dazed, but still on his feet. "Now stop it, Dad. I don't want to fight you, and I ain't stealing Don Knowles' pipe tonight. Dad, now bleeding from his ears, turned and leveled Mike with another right hook. Like hell you're not, boy, he said as he prowled in on his son on the ground. With the 2x4 out of distance and Dad bearing down on him again, Mike grabbed a handful of sandy gravel from the ground and slung it across Dad's face, blinding him. Dad stumbled back, struggling to get his bearings. That's enough, Pop, it's over. But it wasn't. Unable to see, Dad lunged towards Mike's voice. Mike easily sidestepped him. That's enough, Dad! Dad, now a blind, groveling bear with bleeding ears, came at Mike again. Where are you, boy? Where's my son who won't roll Don Knowles' pipe with his old man? Mike picked up the 5-foot 2x4 and held it at the ready. Dad, I'm telling you, it's over. If you come at me again, I'm going to knock you out with this 2x4. Dad heard him clearly, steadying himself, then said, give it your best shot, boy, as he blitzed Mike. Whop! The 2x4 went across Dad's head again. Out cold, Dad lay in a heap on the ground. God damn it, Dad, Mike said in shock, wondering if he killed him. Mike, crying now, knelt down over Dad and yelled, damn it, Dad, I told you not to come at me again. Dad lay there, unmoving. For 4.5 minutes, Mike knelt over his fallen Pop, weeping. I didn't want to do it, Dad, but you made me. Dad then came to and slowly got to his feet. I'm sorry, Dad, Mike shouted. I'm sorry. My dad stood straight and wiped the gravel from his eyes. Mike, crying tears of shock and fear, readying himself for the risk of another round. Dad, eyes now clear, focused in on the young man who had just knocked him out cold, his first son. The fight was over. Tears ran down my dad's face as well, but these were tears of pride and joy. Dad stepped toward Mike with open arms and took him into a loving bear hug, declaring into Mike's ear, that's my boy, son. That's my boy. From that day on, Mike was an equal to Dad, and Dad treated him as such. Dad never challenged Mike again, physically, morally, or philosophically. They were best of friends. You see, rites of passage were a big deal to my dad. And if you were man enough to take him on, then you had to prove it. And Mike just did. To lose the power of confrontation is to lose the power of unity. Second in line to the privilege of my dad's methods of turning his boys into men was Pat. Over the past 40 years, while Rooster has been chasing a career in the oil business in West Texas, and I've been chasing one in Hollywood, Pat has been the fiercely loyal heartist of the family, the one who's always stayed closest to Mom. Growing up, he looked after me, took up for me, let me hang out with his friends, introduced me to rock and roll, taught me how to golf, how to drive, how to ask a girl out on a date, and bought me my first beer. Pat was my hero. His was Evel Knievel. And there's a funny picture of Pat actually catching air and young Matthew, myself, swerving off to the side to take a safer route. Now, Pat's night with Dad came on a Friday in the early spring of 1969, 8 months before I was magically born. Dad was out at Fred Smithers' hunting camp with some friends a couple hours' drive from home. Their night's entertainment had segued into who could piss over whose head the highest. Each man, from shortest to tallest, would stand on the barn wall, put a mark over his head, and the rest of them would see if they could flat-foot piss over the mark. Dad won when he was the only man who could piss 6 feet, 4 inches high, the mark he'd just put over his own head. The prize? Bragging rights. But Dad wasn't the tallest man in the barn that night. At 6'7" tall, Fred Smithers was. And even though Dad had already won the contest, he had to see if he could piss over Fred's head. Fred stood up, marked the wall. Come on, Big Jim, you can do it, his buddies cheered. Pop chugged another beer, leaned back, and let it fly. Nope. 6'4" was as high as he could piss. I knew it. Knew you couldn't piss over my head, Big Jim. Hell, nobody can do that, Fred Smither declared. To which Dad quickly replied, my boy can. Shit, Jim, ain't no way your boy or anyone else can piss over my head, Fred sneered. Like hell he can't. What do you want to bet? Or what do you want to bet? Dad eyed a used Honda XR80 dirt bike leaning against a hay bale in the corner of the barn. You see, Pat had been asking for a dirt bike for Christmas all year long, but Dad knew he couldn't afford to buy one, used or not. I'll bet you that little dirt bike over there, my boy, can piss over your head, Fred. The gang all cracked up at the proposition. Fred looked at the dirt bike, then back to Dad and said, deal. And if you don't, you owe me $200. Well, I ain't got $200 to lose, Fred. But if my boy can't piss over your head, then you can keep my truck, Dad said. Deal, Fred replied. Deal. I'll be back with my boy by sunrise. Don't y'all go to bed on me. And with that, Dad hopped into his beat-up pickup truck and drove 112 miles back to our house in Uvalde to pick up Pat. Wake up, little buddy, wake up, Dad said as he quietly shook Pat from his slumber. Put on a coat and some shoes. We're going somewhere. 8-year-old Pat got out of bed, put on a pair of tennis shoes and a coat over his tighty-whities. Then he headed for the bathroom. No, son, I need you to hold it, Dad said as he rushed Pat out the door. Dad drove Pat the 112 miles back to Fred Smithers' hunting camp and made him drink 2 beers on the way. When he finally got to the camp at 4:40 in the morning, Pat's bladder was full of potential. Dad, I really got to go bad. I know, son. Just hold it a few more minutes. Dad and Pat in his tennis shoes, coat, and tidy whities walked into the barn. The boys had quieted down but were still awake. Fred Smithers, too. Boys, this is my son, Pat. And he's about to piss over Fred's head. They all broke out into laughter again. Game on. Fred sauntered over to the pissing wall, stood up tall, and chalked a fresh line over his head, all 6'7" of his height. What's going on, Daddy? Pat asked. You see that mark on the wall there Mr. Fred just left? Yes, sir. Think you can piss over it? Well, hell yeah, Pat replied. Then he dropped his tighty-whities below his knees, put both hands on his pecker, aimed it at the mark, and let it fly. Pat cleared Fred Smithers' 6'7" mark by 2 feet. That's my boy. I told y'all my boy could piss over Fred's head. Dad hustled over to the corner of the barn, grabbed the Honda XR80 and rolled it over to Pat. Merry Christmas, son. Then they loaded it in the back of Dad's truck, hopped in, and drove 112 miles back home just in time for breakfast. 14 years later, Pat became the number one golfer on the Mississippi Delta State Statesman golf team. A scratch golfer known as the Texas Stallion, Pat had just won low medalist at the SEC tournament at the Arkansas Razorbacks home course. The coach called a team meeting on the bus ride home. Tomorrow morning, my house, 8 a.m. sharp. The next morning, coach gathered the team around him in his living room and said, I have a concern that some players on our team were smoking marijuana in the city park of Little Rock yesterday before the tournament. Now, what we need to do is find out who it was that brought the marijuana from Delta State to Little Rock and who was smoking it. He was staring at Pat. Pat, raised by my dad to know that telling the truth would save your ass, stepped forward. Coach, it was me. I brought the weed and I smoked it. Pat stood there, alone. None of the other teammates moved or said a word, even though 3 of them had passed the doobie with him the other morning in Little Rock. Nobody else? Coach asked. Nothing. I'll let you know what my decision is tomorrow, Coach said. You're dismissed. The next morning, Coach showed up at Pat's dorm room. I'm telling your father and you're suspended from playing golf next semester. Pat caught his breath. Now, come on, Coach. I told you the truth. And I'm the best golfer on the team. Doesn't matter, Coach said. You broke a team rule about drugs. You're suspended. And I'm going to tell your father. Oh, now look here, Coach, Pat said. You can suspend me, but you can't tell my dad. You don't understand. A DWI, you could call him about. But marijuana, no, he'll kill me. Pat had gotten busted with weed a couple of times in his late teens, and after being on the receiving end of Dad's brand of discipline and disdain for Mary Jane before, he was going to make sure there wasn't a third. Well, that'll be between you and him. Coach didn't budge. Pat inhaled deeply. Okay, Coach, let's go for a ride. They got in Pat's 1981 Z28 and headed out for a drive across the Delta. After about 10 minutes of silence, Pat finally spoke up. Let me make this real clear, Coach. You can suspend me, but if you call my dad, I'll kill you. Pat got suspended. My dad never found out. You will hear bumper stickers throughout this book. They are short and sweet and bold. You will also hear what you're about to, which is called prescriptions. They are approaches to life. Help us get more of what we want or get rid of what's ailing us. Have a listen. Conservative early, liberal late. Create structure so you can have freedom. Create your weather so you can blow in the wind. Map your direction so you can swerve in the lanes. Clean up so you can get dirty. Choreograph, then dance. Learn to read and write before you start making up words. Check if the pool has water in it before you dive in. Learn to sail before you fly. Initiation before inaugurations. Earn your Saturdays. You see, we need discipline, guidelines, context, and responsibility early in any new endeavor. It's the time to sacrifice, to learn, to observe, to take heed. If and when we get knowledge of the space, the craft, the people, and the plan, then we can let our freak flag fly and create. Creativity needs borders. Individuality needs resistance. The earth needs gravity. Without them, there is no form, no art, only chaos. As I said, I was an unplanned surprise, an accident, as my mom still calls me, and my dad has always half-jokingly told her, "That ain't my boy, Katie, that's your boy." Dad was on the road a lot when I was growing up, working to take care of the family, so I spent most of my time with Mom. It was true. I was a mama's boy. When I did get to spend time with Dad, I relished every moment. I wanted and needed his approval, and on occasion, he gave it to me. Other times, he just rearranged my considerations in extremely colorful ways. The best way to teach is the way that's most understood. Hee-hee! As a kid, my favorite TV show was The Incredible Hulk, starring Lou Ferrigno. I marveled at his muscles and would pose in front of the TV with my shirt off, arms bent, fist high, doing my best bulging bodybuilder biceps impersonation. One night, Dad saw me. "What are you doing, son?" he asked. "One day I'm going to have muscles like that, Dad," I said, motioning to the TV screen. "Big baseball-sized biceps." Dad chuckled, then took off his shirt, matched my pose in front of the tube, and said, "Yep, big biceps make the girls scream, and they sure look good. But that old boy on the TV there, he's so muscle-bound, he can't even reach around to wipe his own ass. The biceps, they're just for show." He then slowly lowered both his arms in front of him, straightened them out with his fists to the floor, then he twisted his arms to the inside and flexed a pair of massive tricep muscles. "Now the triceps, son," he said, this time pointing his nose back and forth toward the bulging muscles on the back of his upper arms. "That's the work muscle. That's the muscle that puts food on the table and the roof over your head. The triceps, son, they're for dough." My dad would take the stockroom over the showroom any day. It was the summer of 1979 when Dad moved Mom, me, and Pat from Uvalde, Texas, population 12,000, to the fastest growing oil boom East Texas city in the nation, Longview, population 76,000. Where Uvalde taught me to deal, Longview taught me to dream. Like everyone else, we moved for the money. Dad was still a pipe salesman, and Longview was the place to make it rich in the drilling business. Soon after arriving in town, Pat went away to a golf camp, and Mom went on an extended vacation at a beach house in Navarre Beach, Florida. Rooster, already a multimillionaire in his mid-20s, had moved to Midland, Texas, so it was just Dad and me living in a double-wide trailer on the outskirts of town. My dad could hurt with his hands, but he could also heal with them. Painkillers were no match for his hands on my mom's head when she had migraines. Whether it was a broken arm or a broken heart, Dad's hands and his hugs could heal, especially when in service of an underdog or someone who couldn't help themselves. The other inhabitant of that double-wide trailer Dad and I were living in that summer was a pet cockatiel named Lucky. Dad loved that bird, and that bird loved Dad. He'd open her cage each morning and let her fly around the trailer. She'd roost on his shoulder while he walked around and perch on his forearm while he petted her. He talked to Lucky. Lucky talked to him. We only put Lucky back in her cage at night to sleep. The rest of the time, Lucky was loose in the trailer, morning until night. The only rule was you had to watch it when you exited or entered the door so Lucky didn't get out. One late afternoon, after July day of exploring the countryside on foot, I got back to the trailer at the same time Dad got home from work. When we got inside, Lucky wasn't there to greet Dad like she always did. We looked all over. No Lucky. Shit, I thought. Did I accidentally let her out this morning when I left? Did anyone else come over today while we were gone? Seconds later, I heard Dad in the back of the trailer, oh, God, no, Lucky. I ran to the back and found Dad on his knees leaning over the toilet. There, floating in circles in the bottom of it, was Lucky. Tears dripping off his cheeks, Dad reached with both hands in the bottom of the bowl and gently cradled Lucky out. Oh, no, Lucky, no. He groaned through sobs. Lucky was dead, soaking wet, motionless. She must have accidentally fallen in the toilet and gotten stuck beneath the seat's edge trying to get out. Dad, still weeping, brought Lucky's soggy and lifeless body closer to his face where he examined her hanging head. Then he opened his mouth wide and slowly put Lucky into it until the bottom half of her wings and her tail feathers were all that was outside of it. He started to give Lucky mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Only breathing through his nose so to keep constant airflow into her lungs, he made sure his breath was measured. Enough, he hoped, to revive her, but not so much to burst her tiny lungs. On his knees, over a toilet, cradling the bottom half of a cockatiel named Lucky with the top half of the same bird in his mouth, he breathed into her with the perfect amount of pressure. 1 XL. 2 XLs. 3 XLs. His tears soaking the already saturated bird. 4 exhales. 5. A feather quivered. 6 exhales. 7. A wingtip fluttered. 8. Dad lightly loosened his grip and released some pressure from his lips. 9. Another wing tried to flap. He opened his mouth slightly wider. 10. And that's when we heard, coming from inside my father's mouth, a small chirp. Now, with tears of pain turning to tears of joy, Dad gently removed Lucky's torso and head from his mouth. Lucky twitched some toilet water and saliva off her head. Now, face to face, they looked into each other's eyes. She was dead. Now, she was alive. Lucky lived another 8 years.
God's Lucky. The goddess of luck is Fortune. Fortune is the sister of fate. Fate is the divine order, and the divine order is God. So, as far as I can tell, if you believe in luck, you believe in God. That same summer, while Dad was at work every day, I explored the endless acres of the piney woods, barefoot and shirtless, wearing a chamois roped around my waist with my Daisy BB gun in hand. Coming from Uvalde, I'd never seen trees like this, towering pines shooting straight up into the sky, thousands of them. I was in awe of one in particular, a white pine among the ponderosas, 6 feet wide at the base, its peak trespassing the airspace. One late afternoon, while chasing down a squirrel with my Daisy a half mile from home, I came across a fence about 10 feet tall. It was strangled with vines and overgrowth and a few faded no trespassing signs. I crouched, pulled back some foliage, and peeked through. On the other side was a lumber yard, men in hard hats, a couple of forklifts in action, and mountainous stacks of 2x4s, 4x4s, and plywood. Perfect, I thought, for a treehouse. And I knew just the tree. I stayed there until they shut down the forklifts, packed up, and closed down for the day. It was about 6 p.m. I ran home with a plan I couldn't tell Dad, a plan for the next 3 months of my summer. The next morning after breakfast, Dad went to work at 6:30 like he always did. As soon as he left, I went to our toolbox and found what I was looking for, a pair of wire cutters. I put on my chamois, grabbed my Daisy, left my shoes in the closet, and ran to scope out my mark. How was I going to do this? There were people working at the lumberyard all day, so I'd have to come at night, I plotted. What if I got caught by someone at the lumberyard? What if I got caught sneaking out at night by Dad? And what if he then found out I was stealing lumber from a lumber yard half a mile from home? I was nervous. I was excited. That night after dinner and watching The Incredible Hulk like I always did, Dad and I said our goodnights. I lay in bed wondering how long I should wait before I opened the double-wide bedroom window to sneak out. I could hear Dad still moving around on his end of the trailer, so I waited until the slightest creaks had been silent for at least an hour before I made my move. Slowly, quietly, I got out of bed. I wrapped on my chamois skirt, left my shoes in the closet, grabbed my Daisy, a small flashlight, and the wire cutters. I tossed them all carefully out the window onto the lawn below, then snuck myself out the window and headed to my secret stash. It was around 1 a.m. I figured I should be back home in bed before 5, so I had a few hours to work. The yard was quiet. I threw a couple of rocks over the fence to see if any guard dogs were around. Nothing. I pulled back some vines and bushes. Then, with the flashlight between my chin and chest, I brought the wire cutters to the first chain link with both hands. Clip. It took all my double-fisted might to cut through it. Clip. 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 Until I had cleared a space about 6 feet wide and a foot tall, wide enough to get those plywood planks through, small enough to go unnoticed, I hoped. Adrenaline pumping, I lay on my back and shimmied under the fence onto the private property. I went to the stack of 4x4s, pulled one off, and dragged it to the opening in the fence. I pushed it through as far as I could, then crawled under the fence and pulled it out from the other side, where I then dragged it the few hundred yards deep into the forest and left it at the base of the big white pine. Then I ran back to steal the next one. Once I got my second load to the tree, it was already a little after 4:30 a.m., so I raced back to the fence, replaced all the brush and vines to conceal the hole I'd cut, then ran back home. I snuck in the window, put my daisy and the flashlight back on the shelf and the wire cutters under my mattress, got under the covers, and slept until Dad woke me up at 6 a.m. to make breakfast. It went on like this for over a month. Getting little sleep at night, I'd take cat naps under that white pine next to my growing stack of lumber during the day, then make it home for dinner and do it all over again. I did this every night until I had enough 2x4s, 4x4s, and plywood planks to build the biggest and tallest treehouse in the world. With the most dangerous part of my plan behind me and 2 months of summer left, it was time to start construction. I'd also stolen about 40 feet of 15-gauge steel-trimmed pin-nail gun nails from the yard, and I already had a hammer and a 26-inch handsaw from the toolbox at home. All I needed was daylight. Up at 6 and out the door by 7, I worked on that treehouse until dark 7 days a week for the next 2 months. Shirtless and shoeless in my chamois, I crisscrossed 2 paper-collated clips of the nails over my shoulders and across my chest. Half Comanche Indian, half Pancho Villa, with hammer in hand, I went to work. I started with the bottom floor, then I built up. I cut a 2x2-foot hole in each floor next to the trunk of the tree where I nailed pieces of 2x4s for ladder steps to get from floor to floor. I also made a pulley system that I raised with each floor. I'd pack my lunch each morning and take it to my construction site, put my brown bag in the trough, climb up to the highest floor, and hoist my sandwich up to eat during my lunch break. 6 weeks later,